It might be shown or at home. So anyway, the real item of business for today is for Bill to give his practice for a thesis proposal. So this isn't a straight group meeting either. This is particularly a practice event for a proposal defense. But what we're the protocol, of course, is that we interrupt Bill at any point on either content or presentation style suggestions.
So you might be walking
this path. Committee definitely will interrupt him.
Right.
Okay.
I'm Ted Durfee, I'm Jeff Mason, and Bob Savitt, who's a professor in physics.
So
you have two outside
professors. Although calling Jeff an outsider is so it's good to know your committee strategically for your defense. Jeff is gonna be already very familiar with this material, and is gonna be pretty familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
And
So for those of you who don't know, Bob is the director of the program in complex systems. So that's how, you know, it makes sense to have a physics professor on this committee. Okay, so thank you for coming. I look forward to your comments, however scathing they may be. I talked my proposal. It's called Market Protocol for Decentralized Task Allocation and Scheduling. I'd like to start with a concrete example to really motivate the problem I am addressing here. So this is a kind of stylized air combat domain. And what we have here is some commander who wants to perform an air attack. And there are various resources and agents that can help the commander accomplish this task. In this case, the commander simply wants to use a bomber squad and a fighter squad for the air attack. And the bomber squad and the fighter squad, in turn, need to take off from an airfield. For this particular problem, there are excess resources. There are plenty of airfields to satisfy the demand, so we can actually accomplish all the tasks and satisfy this commander without really much difficulty. Now the tricky thing comes in if we actually bring in another commander. The second commander wants to perform a ground attack, which involves a bomber squad, a paratrooper squad, and a fighter squad. And it can be any of these squads, but he does need all three of those squads. Now, the problem is these squads in turn need airfields, each one needs an airfield, but we can't satisfy both of these commanders at the same time, because they need a total of five squads, but there are only four units of the airfield available. So if we need to somehow decide what the more valuable task is, what the best cost-benefit trade-off is, and in this case, reallocate the goods to meet the highest value task. In this case, if we assume the commander two has a higher value, we want to reallocate the resources in such a way to satisfy him.
What's the concept of value?
Value. I'll get to that. Let's just kind of leave that a little bit vague right now. We'll say there's some value to the commanders for accomplishing, tasks, and there may be some costs in providing some of the resources. And I'll formally define what those costs and values look like later.
You know, I think, of course, the reallocation is interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily trivialize the initial allocation in the first place. You might want to say, you know, how we come up with this original solution. In this case, it's easy to find one, but that's part of the work, is how to find solutions in these networks. You know, the static presentation says, okay, you know, where I'm really starting is this reallocation problem.
Okay, so yes. So that first resource allocation was part of the whole allocation problem. That wasn't a particularly difficult one. It becomes a really more challenging problem when you have the limited resources.
Right. Right. So here's, for example, how difficult. But also, in this mentioning the problem, you might want to suggest to them that the details of this really is just completely contrived for a DARPA
a site visitor and what you really after is a general model of you know, these kinds of networks.
Okay. So what I do then, so I want to formalize this model a bit. And I do that in a task dependence network, what I call a task dependence network. That's a general model for how we can do these task allocation problems when we have these sort of hierarchical dependencies and we have to form a supply chain. So let me explain the portions of the task dependence network. Now these circles throughout the network represent the tasks or the resources. In either case, I actually treat them in exactly the same fashion. I assume that a task is performed by one agent on behalf of another, and that the results can't be directly replicated for other agents. If you want to have this task performed for, say, this task performed for two agents, you would have to have two agents performing it. So in that sense, the tasks are really the same as any resource, any discrete resource. These are all discrete. So I basically call them goods. So all these circles represent goods, which can be either, you know, a task or a resource. On this end, I have these boxes.
Another way to rephrase that might be that tasks are resources that are supplied by other agents, and might need another word, but tasks are resources that are supplied by other agents, and then there's some base resources that are supplied in the environment.
That isn't even necessarily quite the correct characterization.
Really is no definition of task as opposed to resources.
That's the whole point.
Sometimes we think of them as tasks, and sometimes we think of them as resources, but there's no distinction.
It may be more natural in some problems or another to call it task or resource when you're actually characterizing
some
specific
things
problem.
They might actually really be production chains where things really are thought of as resources.
You know, a supply chain, you know, producing automobiles or a job shop. The intermediate goods may be physical resources that are produced. So on this end, the boxes are consumers. And a consumer simply wants to acquire some good, and get some value from doing so. On the other end of the supply chain, we have suppliers. And these suppliers are able to supply a good, and perhaps at some cost. The interesting agents in the system are really these ones in the middle. All these boxes in the middle are what I call producers. And a producer has some set of inputs and a single output. So it must acquire all of its inputs in order to produce its output. It cannot do anything with only a subset of its inputs. So in this case, we say that if the inputs are complementary when you have to acquire all of them to produce. For the first example, this is a solution allocation for the problem. What a solution is, first let me back off and say what an allocation is. An allocation is just a subset of the task dependence network that indicates which agents bought and sold which goods. In this case, the green circles are the goods that are bought or sold, that are bought and sold, and the green agents are the agents that bought or sold something. And the dark arrow. Actually, I didn't explain what these arcs are in the previous thing. The arcs. Let me go back. In the arcs indicate input-output relationships. So if an arc from an agent to a good indicates that the agent can supply that good in some sense, and an arc from a good to an agent indicates that the agent wants to acquire one unit of that good as input or for consumption. So going back to an allocation, a dark arrow indicates that the agent either bought or sold the good, and the gray arrows are failed attempts to acquire or sell goods.
You said this was the first example?
Yes. So basically I don't have this commander two here.
Oh, but you have the ground attack.
Well, we could say that this agent exists here, but is not accomplishing anything.
It might be more clear to people if you don't have that ground tech. If you claim this is the first example.
But actually, in a way, it might be clearer if you do, because
well,
it shows
but it looks like
you can accommodate having these things that are just not useful. And
right.
Doesn't wreck anything.
That's right.
So these are all the capabilities in the system. Those don't change. What you're capable of doesn't change. The only thing that changes is what's wanted.
So you might want to. So if you want to make that point, then and keep it this way, then you have to point out. See, just the graph makes it look a lot more like the second example than the first example. So you have to point out that the thing on the bottom isn't commander; it's just the capability.
Okay. So explain what the allocation is. Now, a solution allocation is one where one or more of the consumers actually acquire their goods, and there's basically a complete supply chain all the way back to the suppliers. What that means is, well, there's two things to have a complete supply chain. One is that for any good, the number of input arcs equals the number of output arcs, or in other words, supply equals demand. Another requirement is any producer that is selling its output good must also acquire all of its input goods. So that is, we require that the producers be feasible. And again, here's another example of a...
You can explain the light for me?
Yeah, I'll do that right now. I'll do that. So also, I do have, I want to point out, there's this producer here that is colored light green. I've done that to distinguish it from the other producers. This producer did acquire its input, but didn't sell its output. Now that is allowed in a solution. It's not it's a little bit kind of wasteful to use some resources that really don't, that the producer doesn't want because it's not producing an output. But we need to consider this possibility in these solutions. And again, here's the example again with the second commander coming in and shows how the links change to feed the supply chain into the second commander. Want to talk go back a little bit to the costs and values that I hinted at. I assume that each consumer is interested in potentially some set of goods, but the consumer only wants to acquire one unit of one of the goods. So basically, it can acquire some value for any particular good, but its total value is just the maximum of all those values of the goods that it obtains. The suppliers have some opportunity costs for supplying the goods. This can either be some real cost for, real monetary cost for supplying the good, or maybe some lost value from some other use it could have put the good to. So in this case, I just say each supplier, its total opportunity cost is the sum of the individual opportunity cost for each good.
Since you have the quantifier of G and X in the second bullet, you probably should have it in the first bullet too. So the max over G should be G and X.
Here?
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Now, although this may seem like a somewhat limiting set of utility functions, it turns out that actually with the consumer value, you can model quite a large number of problems by playing some tricks with the suppliers. With the producers. Yeah, with the producers or with multiple consumers. If we wanted to actually model additive value with the consumers, we can simply replicate the consumers and have each different consumer want some different inputs and look at the sum value of them. Another possibility is maybe a consumer wants to acquire multiple goods rather than just a single good. Well, we can do that if we look at here. One way to look at this Commander 2 is we can see that what the Commander really wants is these three separate goods, and this producer is basically defining this good to be the combination of these goods. So we can actually have a large range model a large range of problems and value functions with this simple setup. I want to talk about the value of the overall solution.
Is the second bullet, is there a typo to have a CO on the left-hand side and a OC on the right-hand side?
Yep. So first I'll say the empty allocation where no agent, where there's no agent buys or sells anything, I just define that the value of that to be zero. Now the value of a solution is just the sum of all the values of all that the consumers get minus the sum of the opportunity costs of all the suppliers in the solution. And then I define a globally efficient, which you can also call optimal, efficient is basically the economic term for optimal, allocation is simply maximizes, is either a solution or an empty allocation which maximizes the total value.
Let me just stop you for a minute, Bill. Mm-hmm. So just as a check, I can't judge it because I'm too familiar. Does this make sense to those of you who are not so familiar?
Actually, I wouldn't mind a slide somewhere in the beginning, maybe not that, but that just kind of summarizes where you're going. That I'm following you as I go along, but I'm not sure exactly where you're going. So if there was like maybe after the initial problem description, somebody says this is kind of where I'm going. Yeah.
I think that's a good point. Even whether there's a slide or not, part of what or two was that you started so quickly jumping into something that it wasn't clear. So,
so
maybe it's in conjunction with that first thing. What I'm going to give is an account of how these chains get formed, how to formalize what they mean,
why you're interested in this.
Yeah, you don't want to bog down too much with the complete thing, but I think Tracy's point is that at least have some sense of what the heading is.
Just saying, I'm looking at these task allocation problems where you form supply chains. I'm going to start by giving some motivating examples, then I'll get more into the detail of how I model and formalize the problem, then later talk about some of the mechanisms for achieving that. Something like that.
Yes, yes. If you express that content, I think you would. Is that right, Tracy? With that?
Yeah.
Okay. So getting back to your question about this slide, I'm pretty familiar with this, but I'm having trouble understanding the math. I mean, there's hardly any math there, but I think if maybe symbols or maybe just if you had a picture for each of those two.
Yeah, I kind of went.
You're trying to figure it out.
I went kind of back and forth on that myself.
This is a pretty simple concept. I could just say, say this is the sum. This is a little nicer way to represent this.
I don't know, but maybe someone can give me some suggestions.
In those two examples, those two equations, x is not the same thing, right? We're not looking at.
No, that's, I can use some different letter to indicate it.
The supplier only supply one thing.
Not necessarily.
So he has changed the model since last time, so I think.
It turns out it doesn't really matter whether they supply one thing or multiple things because the value is added, the cost is additive across suppliers, within a supplier and across suppliers. It's just a matter of convenience in modeling some particular problem.
Can you say again why it's the max?
The max? I'm just what I'm assuming here is that a consumer only wants to acquire one good.
Okay.
Or only gets value from one good, and we assume that if it ends up with some set of goods. Well, it gets the value of the maximum good, and all the extra goods don't provide any further value.
But consumers only ever draw where it has inputs that where it requires all of them.
No, all these examples they only have inputs of one.
But if they had multiple inputs, it would be that. The meaning would be they need all,
no.
Just like
no.
The other.
No. Well, no, I'm showing here. So this commander, yes, it does want all of these input.
you can look at it
so
and say you want
that agent, the ground attack, requires all three of those inputs.
All three of those.
That's a producer.
But this is a producer. The commander only wants this and wants this good.
Well,
which
yeah,
is
but
the,
if you had a commander drawn that had two incoming goods.
If that commander has two incoming goods, then it says, I could either have this good or this good. I don't really care to have them both. Having them both doesn't give me any extra value.
So maybe you need a different shape.
Yeah.
Actually, even better. Why don't you just have consumers just take one good? Period. Right? None of your examples.
No, I do have an example with the time dependence.
But
you've changed it because it used to be. I mean, it's easy to picture where consumers are just like everybody else, except they have no output. I mean, there's the semantics of the symbols and stuff. And suppliers are just like everybody else, but they have no input.
Yeah.
Right? But now, if you're allowing commanders or the consumers to have an OR relationship over incoming odds, they're much different than
producers.
So you should have a different shape.
Yeah,
you're right. It's really the limitations of the drawing program that caused me to. In my papers, I was able to draw a nice oval.
No, it's PowerPoint is like.
Yeah, you.
30
shapes. none of them matched well with what I had traditionally in the papers, but.
So I think I don't know. I think the fact that it's all the way on the right and has nothing outgoing is enough of an identifier. And I also think it's okay for it to be different. It is different. Has a different bidding policy. It's not like it's a special case of.
You should use different symbols.
No. Okay. Well, now one thing that might clear up, I think, maybe I should wait on this values and costs until after I do scheduling, because here this is where it becomes really clear why a consumer would want multiple inputs.
It doesn't seem like that stuff at all refers to values and costs, the scheduling, the next two slides of scheduling.
Not explicitly.
Okay, so since they don't...
Okay,
good.
I can change that order.
So I was just going to ask why it's not the case that the consumers and suppliers are not special cases. Is that something that should be clear by now or something?
Well, they're not special case of producers because, a producer, I'll get into this later, but consumers and suppliers can get away with really, really, really simple bidding policies, and it's a little more complex for the producers because they have to get acquire all their inputs in order to sell their output.
Hey, why couldn't you define them to have potential to have OR relationships over inputs too?
The producers?
Yeah.
You could do a lot of things.
Just replicate, but it's easier just to do replicate producers. It's true, there are choices that you could have made other ways and they would have been, why not being equivalent in the end. But I don't know, the reason I don't have an intuition problem is because we producers and consumers always typically are different. There's a qualitative distinction we make in their values and their policies. So that's not a problem.
No, that's not a problem, but I just think producers and consumers have to show a different icon representation.
Yeah. They should,
because I sort of forgot which was the consumer and which was the supplier.
Let me see what I can do about that later. But in terms of
in the graph, the arrows are going to have different meanings depending on which box they're coming into.
They don't have different meanings.
Well, yeah, multiple inputs to a consumer, consumer have an OR relationship, but multiple inputs to a producer have an AND relationship.
No, but that's not what the arrows just mean can make use of, or an arrow from a good to an agent means can make use of. And whether it's, what the combination rule is inherent.
So, I mentioned that this is task allocation and scheduling. I want to suggest how we can actually use this model to perform scheduling. Now, this is not necessarily the only way we would do scheduling, but it's certainly, I think it's a fairly general approach. I'm assuming that we have discrete time scheduling, where we have some range of discrete time slots that we would want to schedule the goods over. The key point here is that we multiply the goods times the number of time slots. So the airfield output, it can be available at time 1, 2, 3, or 4. And now there are certain times where we may want to make use of multiple units of an airfield, maybe two consecutive time units of an airfield, in which case we have arbitrageurs, an arbitrageur will take some number of consecutive time units for some good and produce what I call a temporal bundle good. So this good represents two time units of an airfield ending at time 2. And this one represents two time units ending at time 3, and so on. In this model, I assume that the fighters want to acquire one of these bundles. They don't care which airfield they use, but they want to acquire both of the units from the same airfield, which is why I've split them off in this particular model.
Good question. Couldn't you combine T equals 2 and T equals 4 together to make a bundle for two units ending at time 4?
It depends on
you need consecutive.
In this problem, I'm assuming we want consecutive. There are a lot of ways you could model scheduling depending on what your constraints are. I'm just giving a feel for how one might do this.
So why did you choose to let the fighters get stuff from either airfield now what kind of station that they made for?
Well, I'm just saying, well, let's say for this problem, they can previously they could get it from either 1A or 2B. That was the case before.
1A or 1B.
1A or 1B. There's also 2A and 2B down here somewhere.
Oh, right.
But I'm assuming that whichever one they get it from, they have to get it from both of their units from the same A or B airfield.
Okay. What's that little box for the word arbitrageur?
That was a conversion problem from PowerPoint, whatever I had before, to PowerPoint, what you have here.
What was there?
There was nothing there. there's a space or something.
It might be clear if that label 2-2, maybe since you have room, what if you just spelled out airfield parentheses 2-2?
Yeah, I think you're right. There is room for that. Okay.
What does ATT mean under the fighter type 1?
Yeah, that's another thing. One thing you might do is italicize T.
Okay.
I don't know if you're going to do it in
the
computer. And a computer from the computer doesn't work as good as
it. I'll play with that to make it better. Might put the at back up here.
Write an at sign.
Okay. Now, I also want to mention that sometimes when we go into scheduling, we don't want to make all the goods, we don't want to make them all temporal goods like this. I'm assuming in this problem that the fighters, we're just scheduling the airfield over some short period of time. But once the fighters go out, they take several hours to perform their attack, and that's beyond the scheduling horizon. So I assume that actually using the fighter squad, that's actually consumed, and you can't use the same fighter squad over multiple time periods. So I don't multiply this time four times. I can just have a single unit of it, and to perform a fighter attack, you have to acquire one unit of it. And this guarantees that only one of these time slots can actually be active for the fighter attack.
Why do you have another good at the very end?
Why do I have these?
Yeah.
This represents a fighter attack at time 2, at time 3, and time 4. A fighter attack requires use of the fighter squad and also the airfield.
Doesn't that rectangle represent a fighter attack at time 2?
This? This is a fighter attack producer.
So you don't have a consumer.
Not okay. I'll get to that. It's too big to put on a single screen. I should have mentioned that this is only a portion of the network.
I don't know if this would work, but if you could take the previous network and a little box up in the corner and draw, put, you know, some color on the part that you're exploding, that might help place it.
Say, one thing we could have learned from Porvitz's talk yesterday is all the animation techniques.
I might be able to do that.
I don't know if it would work, but it would help us transition to this.
I certainly should explain up front that this is only a portion of the network. That's something I neglected to do. Now this is at the other end of the network, a portion of the other end with Commander 1. This is Commander 1, and it wants an air attack, and it can have the air attack at time 2, 3, or 4. And we might assume that the commander has a different value for acquiring the air attack at the different times. Maybe earlier is better, or maybe we could even say that at time 4 is too late, and we might have a zero value there, for instance. So, and then this is where I go and talk about the values again. instead. So I just talked about values.
We're not going to get back to scheduling again after this, right?
Not explicitly. So the point here is that I've modeled scheduling within the same framework as basic task allocation. So any result I prove about the general task allocation model will, by definition, apply to the scheduling also. So this shows that I have a very general model, and I can simultaneously do the scheduling and the task allocation. So I'm going, in general, I'll be focusing on the basic task allocation model without looking at any particular scheduling problems, generally because it takes too much space. So I've talked about an efficient solution is in terms of the value to the agents. What we want to do is to somehow construct these solution supply chains. And we want, preferably, we'd like to have very high value, efficient solutions. The question is, how do we do that? We can certainly do this in a centralized system using various.
That talk about value. You don't have value of a solution yet.
I talked about. Yeah, I did.
You did.
Yep.
Oh, you did. Okay,
yep.
You had that. Okay.
Yep.
Sorry.
That's why it probably works better.
Yes.
Up here.
Yeah.
So. So we can certainly do this in a centralized solution using various and/or search techniques, but I'm assuming that we actually are working in a distributed system where these agents are actually autonomous units that have their own local information, and they aren't aware necessarily aware of the whole system, and they maybe don't want to reveal all their information to the whole system directly. So,
do you have any good reason to argue that that might be the case in the military application?
Well, I don't think you want to argue specifically on military. You want to argue that it's relevant to some common applications.
Right. And it's a little ironic that you choose the military as the example when they have a much more hierarchical.
Remember, the military is the one giving us money.
I
do want to sidestep the issue of under what conditions you do take a decentralized approach. I'm assuming that there are some either social or technological constraints that really require we take some distributed, that our solution approach be distributed in some way. And what I want to do is look at, how far can we go in doing this? In solving this in a decentralized way, what is kind of the extreme decentralized approach to this? Now the economic answer to that is to introduce a price system, and what a price system is it just assigns a non-negative number to all the goods in the system. Here, just these numbers with the dollar signs next to the goods indicate prices. What these prices do is indicate the relative global value of the various goods as compared to the other goods. And the agents then will use this local information of their goods of interest and the prices thereof to guide their decision-making process in determining the final allocation. So the question is, how do the agents do this? What are their incentives in this crisis? Yeah?
You have prices on producer, consumers and suppliers.
Okay. The values I put on these agents, on the consumers and suppliers, represent their values, these numbers. And while the numbers on the goods represent their prices, by placing a dollar sign both on the prices and the values, I'm implicitly saying that the values and the costs are represented in monetary units. So basically on the same scale. And I'll formally explain what that is here.
Maybe you would want to, back on that slide, put V.
Value
V equals $10.
Right, and OC equals 2 or 3 on the left side.
Okay. That's a good idea.
But also, if you want to say anything about, pointing out that the ground attack makes a profit and the commander too is happy, without going through the whole thing.
So, let's say I was good. I could talk about that. So I'm going to talk about formally here. Maybe
it
it's
might
good.
Help to give an example. Just look at eyeballing a network first, and then
it's a good idea.
Is that Paratrooper 1 supposed to be green?
Paratrooper 1. That is a bug. Get rid of that. No. That isn't a bug. That's a bug. That's not green. Thank you. So what's going on here? Well, how do these agents use these prices to guide their decision making? Well, these consumers want to acquire a good at a price below their value. So you can see that this commander is acquiring its input good for $22, which is less than its value of 30. And the suppliers, on the other end, are willing to sell their good if they can recoup their costs, at least recoup their costs. Now, the producers in the middle don't have any intrinsic value for the goods, so what they're looking for is just strictly profit. They'd be willing to be active in the solution if the their output price is greater than or equal to the sum of their input prices. And this is just a formal statement of that. The agents would want to maximize their surplus, where the surplus is defined as I specified. It's basically the difference between the value they get and the costs incurred. So in the general equilibrium approach, the ideal situation is to end up with a competitive equilibrium through equilibrium. What this means is simply that there's a set of prices such that and an allocation such that the agents get an optimal surplus allocation at the equilibrium prices. What this means is the consumer will get the single good that maximizes its surplus. Maximizes the difference between the value of the good it gets and the price of that good. If it gets any other goods in this model, the prices better be zero because they're not adding any extra value. A supplier will simply sell each good that for which it can they can sell for a price higher than the value for that good. And the producers will buy all their inputs and sell their output if they're profitable. Otherwise, they want to trade nothing. And so this includes both the optimality constraint and also the feasibility constraint I talked about before. And also require that supply and demand be balanced.
But some producers end up negative value.
That's not an equilibrium by this definition.
Oh.
So,
do you need to explain a competitiveness assumption? Are you making a competitiveness assumption?
It's implicit in this. I'm not talking about competitiveness is when you're talking about behavior. I'm not talking about behavior. The only assumption is here is that they're optimizing with respect to prices only.
The current prices.
Right.
So
with respect to some set of prices. I'm sidestepping the issue of how you would get a competitive equilibrium right now.
Right, but what makes it a competitive equilibrium is that everything is relative to given prices, and that's stated there.
So what are the, so here's an example of competitive equilibrium. In this case, you notice that for all the green agents, they're making a positive surplus, or a non-negative surplus at least. So for instance, this agent, its output is $6.50, and its inputs are $6. So it's making a 60-cent profit, 50-cent profit, and it's willing to be active.
So those are AB to E.
A, B, T, yes.
Same with BC to
D.
D, D. B, C, D.
Yep.
Just go through all those notes and make sure they're right.
Okay. So for instance, this agent is profitable. This agent has the input costs. Input prices are total to 7, but its output is only 650. So it wouldn't want to take part in the solution. So therefore, you can see that it's excluded. Now, just by definition, the equilibrium is stable with respect to prices. Another important aspect.
What does that mean?
It's stable with respect to prices, meaning that no agent would want to do anything differently at the current prices.
Unilaterally.
Actually, yes. No individual agent would want to deviate from the allocation it receives. It couldn't do any better at the current prices. The equilibrium is globally efficient. So what this means is, for this model, when the agents optimize locally, we're also optimizing globally. And this is due to the fact that they have this what we call quasi-linear value, which means they value goods in, their value is linear in the money, the amount of money they acquire. And that means they can transfer the utility on a common scale.
So you know that the only competitive equilibrium prices that exist are the efficient prices, or support the efficient allocation. There's no inefficient equilibrium.
Equilibrium is globally efficient. There may be multiple equilibria, but any equilibria you come up with has to be globally efficient.
But that's not necessarily true for all discrete resources.
But it's true for this model.
It's
not
true for this model.
You've proved it in your proposal.
Yeah. I proved it for this particular model. You could come up with different value functions for which that may not hold true. And as you know, bundle pricing schemes. But unfortunately, an equilibrium actually may not exist when you have the discrete goods and complementarities, which we do have in this problem. I'll show you a particular example of where you may not have equilibrium. Basically, what I show here are the constraints on the prices for all the goods. This constraint...
So, first of all, what's different from this and the previous example?
Okay, the only difference here is that the consumer has a lower value. Let me explain that. So this is showing...
What was it before?
I think it was 15. The key here is that the total cost for the solution is 7. And the consumer has a value of 9. So if we were to have an equilibrium, it should be this solution because that's efficient. However, I'm going to show that we can't have an equilibrium if the consumer has a value this low. And the reason is, so if we look at this constraint, this is to ensure that this agent is profitable. On the other hand, this constraint is to ensure that this agent is not profitable. Because if we raise this sufficiently high, then this agent can't make a profit on there. But what that means that if you take these two constraints and feed them together, we have that the price of F has to be greater than or equal to 11. So even though this particular solution would be efficient for the consumer having a value range from anywhere above 7. We actually can't have an equilibrium if its value is below 11.
Well, the consumer shouldn't be greedy.
No, I'm just saying this is what the allocation would be.
Oh, the green is the optimal allocation. But
so that,
well, it's just a solution.
It's just some. It's a solution allocation that it happens to be the optimal one.
So the minimum cost of the solution is really set.
Yeah. Yes. If the consumer had a value as low as 7, we would still have. It would still be efficient. This solution would still be efficient. However, for certain range of consumer values, we can't get an equilibrium.
The way you explained it was that price has to be high enough such that the supply, the producer was not active.
Correct.
But why is it the case that we don't want it to be active?
Because if
why do you want to force it?
Well, first thing, we have to remember this producer has to acquire this input. So that means that this producer should not be allowed to. So that therefore this producer has to supply this input. Since this and therefore this producer shouldn't end up buying anything. Since it can't buy this, it shouldn't do anything at all by the equilibrium conditions. It should either sell its output and buy all its inputs or else do nothing. That's the only way to have a solution here.
The constraint on price of C, should that be greater than or equal to 1?
No, less than or equal to 1, because we don't want this supplier to be active.
You could put it for the consumer's value, V between 7 and 11. Or, so what you're saying is for any value in that range, there's no equilibrium.
Yeah, that might be clear just to say, well.
So actually, I'm not sure why the constraint, why is it greater than 5? Because price of C could be as high as 1.
Well, it can be, okay, but the higher that this is, the higher, let me see. You're right, so this could
D can be as low as 4, really.
It could be
so
as low as 4. It could be as low as 4, right.
So it's really only 10 now. Still.
Yep. Yes. So equilibria don't always exist. Now I have. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. The question is, when they do exist, how can we reach them? And what do we do when we don't have equilibria? Or can we even always each reach equilibrium when they exist? In the auction theory literature, there's been a lot of work looking at price-based auction mechanisms that try and reach equilibria or some approximation of equilibria. Sometimes you can't reach it exactly. When they don't each reach equilibria, the idea is to hopefully have produce an allocation with a sufficiently high, with a fairly high efficiency. One common approach to this, using these price-based methods, is the simultaneous ascending M plus first price auction. And this was actually used for the FCC radio spectrum auctions a few years ago.
Really, was it M plus first price?
It was a simultaneous ascending auction. This is a variant of the type of auctions that were used for the FCC auctions.
They had a lot of other rules in there, too.
Right. So this is a variant. It's not exactly the same.
So when you say often used, say, simultaneous ascending auction.
Right.
That's commonly used, and here's...
We're using a particular variant with an M plus first price auction rule. So there's an auction for each good. One important point is this auction is two-sided. Both the buyers and the sellers will bid in the auction. And it's an iterative, asynchronous auction that runs, according to this high-level structure. First, some agents bid, and whenever an auction receives a bid, it issues a price quote. And then maybe some agents, when they receive that price quote, will decide to change their bid, in which case the auction will submit a new price quote and repeats this continuously until the agents stop bidding, at which point we've reached quiescence.
So that's kind of weird. What is it? What is the bid? This is supposed to be the program for the auction?
This is really the protocol for the agents and the interaction between the agents and the auction. I mean, I could say receive bid.
So how about just, instead of repeating anything, how would you have a loop that says something like, until quiescence, on bid,
issue price quote. And then clear.
Good.
But I mean, the point is, it's event driven. The auction, the auction is completely event driven. It receives bid. When it receives bid, it does something.
Right, right, right.
And then when Crescent's reached, it exits that event driven mode and just does something.
Okay. We'll agree to that. So that continues until the agents stop bidding, at which point the auctions will clear. And the clearing determines the final prices for the goods. And actually, I should explain what the price quotes are. I think I glossed over that. And, so let me go back. So let me rephrase this. So whenever an auction receives a bid, it will issue a new price quote. And a price quote basically provides some intermediate information which specifies what the prices would be now based on the current state of bids. Now, of course, this is subject to change, because once the agents receive these price quotes, they may want to submit new bids. So every time the agents do submit a new bid, the auction then submits a new, releases a new price quote. And this continues until all the agents stop bidding, at which point we're at quiescence, what I call quiescence. When this is finished, the auctions will clear. And a clearing, it determines the final prices. It determines an allocation, which specifies which agents get what. Now, throughout this bidding process, the auctions require that both the buy bids and the sell bids must increase. And this is a little bit different from standard auction, much of the auction literature, where only the buy bids must increase. But we do find that requiring both buy and sell bids to increase is important for proving some of the convergence properties we achieve.
It's different mainly because most ascending mechanisms are only one-sided.
That's true. So. Well, there are some two-sided auctions where the sells must go down and the buys must go up. But I don't want to go into too much detail about what's involved in the clearing, but the important point is that the auctions balance the reported supply and demand at a uniform price. So each auction specifies a single price at which all the agents trade at that auction. Now, this is a very complicated problem to analyze. The ideal traditional approach would be to calculate a Bayes-Nash equilibrium on behalf of for each of the agents and assume that the agents behave rationally according to the Bayes-Nash equilibrium. Unfortunately, doing so is kind of beyond the state of the art and for something this complex. So we are simply assume that the agents use some very simple bidding policies that do obey the ascending restriction and also can obey the decentralization constraint in that the agents only consider the goods of direct interest to them. So the suppliers simply bid their fixed, I should change that to cost, they simply bid what their costs are for their goods. And a consumer will start by bidding zero for all of the goods of interest, and whenever it's not winning a bid, it will raise its bid on one of its goods of interest that would maximize its surplus at the current prices, and it increments it by a small amount. The producer is the interesting agent here, as I mentioned. For its output,
it increments beyond the current quote.
Yes, a small amount beyond the current price quote. The producer will bid for its output the sum of its of the current prices of its inputs. And it will also add a small increment for each input that it's currently losing. And that's under the assumption that if it's losing an input, it could actually win it if it bid a little bit higher than the current price. For the inputs, a producer will start by bidding zero, and then will increment a bid on an input whenever it's infeasible. That is, when it's winning its output, but losing that particular input. Now, I'll give you a concrete example of the producer here. Now, this is a producer. The prices are specified here in the current bids. The green arrows indicate bids that it's currently winning, and this red arrow indicates the bid that it's currently losing. So the producer has no reason to raise its input bid on A because it's winning it. However, so it holds that bid at 2. However, the producer is winning its output but losing this input, so it would raise its bid on B to 2. For its output, it will bid the sum of its input prices, 2 plus 1, and it'll also add an increment on for this bid because it's losing it. So it will bid a total of 4. Here, I'm assuming that we have an increment of $1.
Why is it that the suppliers and the consumer, the suppliers and the producers, when they're selling things, they're not doing anything strategic, they're just bidding their top valuation?
You're right. Okay, the consumer doesn't just bid its top valuation. It kind of is slowly increments.
No, when they're selling.
The consumer doesn't. The producer when it's selling?
It's just the sum of its input. It's not trying to make any profit.
You're right. I'm assuming I'm kind of ignoring strategic issues here. We could look at situations where a producer would bid for its output some linear function of the inputs. And actually, everything I prove would still follow based on that. Would still follow for that modification. Some of the empirical results I show would definitely be altered by that sort of profit.
It just seems that the producers are trying to get the lowest possible price for the things they're buying, but they're not. They're just trying to sell it for no profit at all. And also, the suppliers are just trying to sell it.
So for no profit. Well, they're saying is that no. In this case, no profit is good enough. They may end up getting positive profit.
Is it incentive? It's not incentive.
No, it isn't. So that's something I want to address in this thesis in this work is actually looking more carefully, developing a good model of the agent incentives and trying to analyze a little bit more carefully what the agents might be.
But it's not as bad as the fact that it's M plus first price does reduce the disincentive for bidding to sell at your actual costs.
Okay.
An earlier result is that the M plus first price auction, that M and M plus first price auctions are incentive compatible for buyers or for sellers. One is compatible.
That does not hold in an iterative, if you have iterative auctions.
Okay, so that result is.
Right.
There may be incentive compatibility for, say, both buyers and sellers in each auction.
No, we shouldn't expect any sort of incentive compatibility.
Yeah, it only makes it worse.
Well, another thing is, it's really hard to talk about you can't talk about incentive compatibility for the producers anyways. You can only talk about incentive compatibility when you have a set value for a good. The producers want to make profit, and they just have
You could talk about an incentive compatible strategy.
Well, if you fixed the prices of all but one good, you could talk about, what's the incentive for bidding on the other one? But the producer knows that those prices are dynamic.
Oh, I see. Producer.
Right. But this is not an iterative. I mean, the price quotes are iterative, but it's not an iterative auction. It's a one shot. It only wants to fix
it. It only clears once, but it's iterative in that it provides intermediate price information. And that really
ruins
The bidding actions.
That is what it is.
Yeah.
So actually, you're right. There's a weird thing because this isn't a direct mechanism where the producers just report their types. Actually, if they did, all they would say is, here's my inputs, here's my output.
Correct.
That would be the only information.
Correct.
I was wondering, is there some way you could describe the producer's bid on his output as a function of the price quote? Like, it can only raise it if its costs are greater than the current bid price, than any buyer is willing to pay, then it might choose to just raise it as little as possible. But if it's actually less than some buyer is willing to pay, it could raise it up to that price. And that would be profit maximizing. Simple profit maximizing. And it probably turns out that as the network progresses, the consumers never bid any more than they have to, so that it stays at this lower, the
more about. Sort of.
So an explanation for why this might be a reasonable strategy could be that you could, a simple bidding policy for the producer would be to bid as much as anybody's willing to pay.
But they don't know what anybody's willing to pay.
Well, there's a price quote.
But what anyone's willing to pay, it comes from the consumers way down here. And that information slowly gets filtered back, but indirectly.
So it's at some intermediate point, there is a price quote that says that someone has offered, effectively someone's offered to pay this buyer.
Well, you can't really tell that, but you do. There is a bid quote.
Yeah.
You can't tell if it's from a buyer.
Right. So, but you know there's a buyer out there.
You're right.
So since you have a bid quote, you can say that the consumer, the producer, will offer to sell it at that quote, or if the costs are greater than that, then they just choose the minimal amount over that quote, hoping to be to later win as the prices rise.
I think all these price quotes are very tentative. I guess I'm still not.
Yeah, but you're assuming that they're taking prices as given.
I mean, the reason why they might not just set a big price is because they want to try to sell the resources,
but
they have some information about what someone's willing to pay for.
But what I'm assuming is here, when you bid for your output, you're assuming that you want to at least cover the cost of your inputs.
Right. So, but if it so happened that the bid price was much more than that, than the cost of your inputs, then a reasonable strategy would just be to bid that.
No, you could say a regional strategy is to stop bidding on your inputs, maybe. But
if someone's willing to buy it for a lot more than it costs you, you don't want to stop bidding on your inputs. You want to try to capture that surplus.
But you would if the world ended today, because it's an M plus first price auction, even by bidding your true costs.
Right.
You're the seller. You're going to. The buyer's going to get it. You're not going to get it.
Oh, I see. That's right.
So that seems like a reasonable story, right? And I think it's also true that it turns out that these bidding policies make it so that you're almost always in the situation where you're placing your bid where you're above. You have to, because your inputs have increased, your new bid has to be greater than what someone's willing to buy. Not necessarily.
You don't know that they're going to. It may
not their true value, but their current stated value in the price.
It may or may not be higher than that. Yeah, you're winning. You know that you're winning this at some price. If you bid above that current bid price, that's because your current costs are too high. If you bid below it, then your costs are less than that, and you're still going to stay in the game.
So look at it this way. Suppose that Dave and I are sellers and you're a buyer. We know that you've offered to buy a 10, and it cost me 3.
Right.
So I say, I know, I'm going to offer to sell at 9. Let's try to get more than the surplus. Well, Dave comes in and offers to sell at 8, and I can't lower the price because it's an ascending auction. I'm screwed. So that's one reason why I shouldn't have gone right to 9. I should have stayed at 3. I can raise it to 9 later, maybe.
But if you were the only supplier.
Well, I have no way of knowing that.
Now I guess I'm understanding. You're saying the bid all the way up. Well, also you have to keep in mind that might work okay if you're the only seller selling to a consumer. But if you're somewhere in the middle of the chain, you bid up too high on multiple ends, then...
Well, yeah, so I think that there's some way to help explain, to help raise the intuition about why you might not want to raise your bid. Why you might, as a seller and a producer who's selling, you might want to stick to this simple policy.
So I think it is hard to justify in the end. I think the main justification is it's myopic and simple.
Well, it's not really that. I mean, it's not optimal.
No. I can't argue that.
Assuming they have both been an asshole.
But I think the point, I mean, it's a good point, is that the strategic issues, though, are really complicated. And no, you're not going to be able to successfully argue for it. You could try some things, but I don't know, it's probably not worth it. It might.
But some simple intuitions might. Like,
but they're wrong, the simple intuitions. You know, they don't really go through.
Well, but the first impression of this bidding strategy is just that it's so natural for sellers to raise the bids, because that decreases the chances.
But what we know is that there's actually lots of strategies that all seem plausible. And some of them don't work. Most of them don't work, and the one that Bill identified works. And that's really
interesting.
It's not because it's more strategically appropriate than the others at all.
So some justification, even if it's just that you know, there are lots of other ones, but they don't think they work, but this one does, would help.
Yep. Well, I'll say up front clearly, there are potentially lots of bidding strategies, some of which may work better or be more strategically sound in some respect. We do know that this does have some desirable properties, and it's what we've explored it in depth for the system.
Now, I talked about the equilibrium before. I talked about a pure competitive equilibrium. I've also defined something called a lambda-delta competitive equilibrium, which is an approximate equilibria where the error from equilibria is corresponds to the increment parameters in the bidding policies. And it turns out that this, the reason why I specify this is because when we have these discrete jumps, we can it's pretty impossible to exactly hit an equilibria. You may miss it by a little bit, but just introducing these parameters in the concept means we can talk about some equilibria we sometimes get close to. And this approximate equilibria is inefficient in proportion to the bid parameters. So it's suboptimal by some bounded amount, which in proportion to these parameters. And it turns out that this the increment and the loss and the input, the increment on your output and your input for the producers, and also consumers. And it turns out that this bidding policy and the auction mechanism, if that results in no dead ends on the producer, and a dead end is a producer that buys some inputs but not his output. So if we have no producers like that, then we have this lambda-delta competitive equilibrium. And this is an if and only if statement. Now, even when we generalize this notion of equilibrium, we're not guaranteed to reach that equilibrium, even when one exists, for two general reasons. One is we may overshoot the equilibrium prices. The price of this good goes higher than the minimum equilibrium price. This agent is bidding higher than 11 here because of that increment on its inputs. So we can overshoot it. And also, as I mentioned, we can have dead ends where this is what happens when you actually run the system, where you have a producer like this that buys an input but doesn't sell its output. So that's how we can miss the equilibrium. So since the equilibria we can't always get an equilibrium, I define a somewhat weaker notion on prices called a valid solution, where basically all the agents in the solution have a non-negative surplus, except for some producers may buy some inputs but not sell their output.
Or the word surplus twice.
Yep. Thanks. So when we define this, we can talk about some properties of this bidding policy and auction mechanism. Because of the ascending auction rule, the bidding does always stop. We always reach quiescence. If we reach a valid solution and the price of the goods for any losing consumer is higher than their value, then we'll reach quiescence with a valid solution. On the other hand, if we reach quiescence and at least one consumer is winning, we have a valid solution. Empirically, I've also, based on many thousands of experiments, I find that if at least some consumer in the system values it's a good high enough, that's relative to the other values in the system.
So when I say thousands of experiments, it's really thousands of randomly generated examples.
Thousands of
randomly generated instances.
Okay, thousands of, you know, about 3,000 randomly generated instances, I find that if the consumer values a good highly enough, then a valid solution will form for that consumer. Now, I talked about this problem of these dead-end producers that buy their inputs but not their outputs. We can improve the efficiency of the system by allowing decommitment on those producers. And what that basically means is any producer that buys some inputs but not its output can decommit from those input contracts. And then we recursively go back to the suppliers and basically cut off that portion of the supply chain. And as an example, what we do here is we basically let this producer and this supplier decommit from their contracts. And that would increase the efficiency, and actually increase the value of solution by $1 in this case. And in this case, we would have the optimal solution with the decommitment.
And an equilibrium.
No, we're not. Well, if you not in equilibrium, because you still have because of the prices. If you actually threw them out of complete consideration, all the rest of the agents are in an approximate equilibrium. I've done some more empirical analysis based on over 3,000 randomly generated trials with a range of goods and agents. I measured the fraction of optimal surplus. So I compared the economy run with an A-star surge, and this protocol with the bidding policies and the options I specified give a mean efficiency of 83%. But when we include the decommitment, the efficiency rises to 97%. I found that 90.
Well, you really need to qualify those numbers to point out.
I was going to do that at the end.
I think right when you mentioned those numbers, you got to. The next ones are much less arbitrary, so I think it's worth making the point with respect to these numbers.
So one thing we have to be a little bit wary of is remember that I have this conjecture that if some consumer values its goods sufficiently highly, we'll reach a solution. Well, we could set some consumer's value to an arbitrarily high number and know that we're going to reach a solution, and there we could get arbitrarily high values because we get arbitrarily close to optimum efficiency if that consumer's value dominates all other values in the system.
If the consumer's value is a billion, then it doesn't really matter. Then the surplus, it's a billion minus 10 versus a billion minus 9.
Right.
You know, you're not going to be able to measure much difference in that fraction. Whereas 9 versus 10 could be significant. Actually, it's not 9. A billion minus 10 versus a billion minus 1, they're pretty much the same. Whereas
right.
Cost ratio is still.
So we have to. Yeah, I tried to design these experiments so that isn't a strong artifact, but we have to keep that in mind. I did find that 37% of the trials converged to the approximate equilibrium I talked about, and of those that did not converge to an equilibrium, the remaining ones had a 73% efficiency, and when we include the decommitment, we had a 95% efficiency. So what this suggests is that this protocol is, it sometimes reaches equilibrium, but it produces good results on average, even when it doesn't reach equilibrium.
So do you have any sense of what fraction actually have an approximate equilibrium?
I do not have that. I haven't tried to measure that. That would
be hard now.
Yeah. So I don't have that sense.
Somewhere between 37 and 100%.
Right. Now, we certainly know that, I guess I don't have the actual statistics here of how many were improved by the decommitment. There was a good chunk of them were improved by decommitment, and so we at least anything that's improved by decommitment could have maybe had an equilibrium, but we know we definitely missed it. Well, Actually, I'm not going to go there. So I don't know how many actually have an equal wood room. So yeah, that 37% could, you know, includes both the protocol and, you know, errors in the protocol, and also just non-existence in equilibrium. And yeah.
63%.
Yes.
Those are the means. Do you have, what's the distribution like? Is it like almost all 100%?
It's heavily weighted in the 90% and above region, very heavily weighted. Basically, over 90% of the trials had 90% or greater efficiency. The part of the reason why these numbers are as low as they are is because there's a good chunk of results of runs that had negative value, because so basically the cost overwhelmed the value to the consumers, and that's why the decommitment was so useful, because it got rid of a lot of wasted resources, you know, decommitted from a lot of wasted resources.
Do you have any feel for how the number of trials that converge to equilibrium varies as the size of the economy grows?
No, I don't. It's really hard to measure the size of the economy. You know, I mean, you can talk about the number of goods, the number of consumers, number of agents. Then the interconnectedness. I showed you a very simple, small economy with no equilibrium. I didn't do that measure because I think it would be misleading. Such a simple measure.
By the way, I would expect, you know, now reading the committee, Professor Durfee to push you a bit on the empirical trial part of things.
Push me in terms of
why did you do this instead of that? What could you measure? What would you be measuring?
Okay. So I've talked about the results of this protocol. There's one thing I sidestepped is how do we know when we've reached quiescence? That's a straightforward thing to do if we're simulating this on a centralized system where we know what the state of all the agents in the auctions. It's a much more difficult problem when we have decentralized auctions and agents running on separate processes and on an asynchronous system. The problem is that local quiescence at one auction does not imply global quiescence. So agents may have stopped bidding at one auction, but there may be still activity going on in other parts in the economy. And if there's still activity elsewhere, prices could propagate back to that auction and there would be later activity.
So actually, it's not even clear what local quiescence means.
So local quiescence meaning if a particular auction hasn't received bids for, 5 seconds or whatever time period.
Well, it doesn't mean that, Masoners. It means that no one wants to bid at the current price.
Right.
In the current state, no one even wants to.
Right.
But the point is they may want to later.
Right.
Based on a change in another.
Correct.
So you want maybe something like, current quiescence at a certain time, which you'll define later, does not mean that it's going to stay quiescent if there's other options that are still active.
Or you could say inactivity at one option.
Inactivity at one.
Yeah, I like that. I think inactivity is just, so, we could have timeouts and say, the auction could ask all its bidders, do you want, there are a lot of ways you could, check for inactivity, but the point is that's not a good measure of global quiescence. The trick is we want to have all the auctions reach consensus on quiescence by doing it in a decentralized manner. We don't want to have some centralized agent orchestrating all this. We want to have the messages following the natural flow in the task dependency network. It's going to give a high-level view of how we can do this. One thing I do is when we have multiple consumers, there is some sort of meta-consumer that I introduced that is used to coordinate the consumer's activities. So we do have to have some control over, we have to have some knowledge about what's going on with the consumers, but we don't have to look at the rest of the economy. Basically, when we have consumers not wanting to change their bids, they pass a message called that says I'm quiescent in it, and if the rest of the network is really quiescent also, it will propagate back to the suppliers. But if at any point new bids come about, that message will not be propagated back, and the auctions will wake up and continue their bidding. The auctions will continue their price quotes, and the agents will continue their bidding. Once that those messages reach the suppliers, if the suppliers are really, agree that they're quiescent, they don't have anything they want to change, they will say, they'll send a message firm, which basically says, I am firm, I'm certain that I'm quiescent locally, and agents and auctions will propagate that message back to the consumers if they agree with that message, if there haven't been any price changes or new bids. And once this information propagates to the meta consumer will send a signal saying, a clear signal, basically, which will propagate through the network, and all the auctions will close down and clear.
Is that consumer a bid? Maybe the meta consumer?
All it serves is to pass these messages.
Maybe you could just call it a quiescence detector or something. Using the word consumer.
Yeah, meta consumer.
Yeah. Now, there are some restrictions on how this operates. I assume that messages always get delivered in some finite period of time in order between two agents. However, I don't place any arbitrary time bound on them, on the messages. Also, I assume that the auctions know who their bidders are, so that they know if they've received messages from every agent.
How do you know if you got all the firms?
Basically, an auction will pass a message only if it receives a firm from all of its bidders. That's why you have to know who your bidders are. And the same with the quiescent. Basically, the message is, auction passes on a message only if it receives it. Passes a quiescence only if it receives it from all its buyers. It'll pass on a firm only if it receives it from all its sellers. And it turns out, given these assumptions with this protocol, auctions will clear if and only if we have global quiescence.
There's a certain incentive for the agents who are buying something but they're not able to sell it, that may not want to send out the firm message.
So there's another issue. Do agents want to actually participate in this protocol?
Right.
And that's something that I need to look at in combination with the incentives for the bidding policy. What I'd like to do is perhaps we can combine this quiescence detection protocol with the decommitment protocol, and if we can somehow combine the signals so agents can signal, okay, I'm detecting quiescence, but you got to let me decommit because I'm not ready here. Briefly touch on some related work. A lot of work has been done for task allocation in task-oriented domains. Here, there aren't these... They don't have these task dependence networks. They have tasks.
Task-oriented domain is not, that's a specific word that Rosenstein thought.
Yes, that Rosenstein and Zlotkin have defined, and others such as Sandholm have also pursued work in that general area of domain. And the idea is that to reallocate tasks among agents, basically any reallocation of tasks is feasible, but there are different costs depending on what combination of tasks that agents have. Anderson and Sandholm have looked at contract decommitment and in a task-oriented type domain, and they found also that decommitment can greatly improve the efficiency. Davis and Smith invented a protocol called ContractNet, which actually does look at these hierarchical dependencies in the supply chain formation. It takes a different approach. It does a top-down allocation starting from the consumer, which means that if there are resource limitations in the system, there would have to be some sort of backtracking to account for that. And usually, they don't usually approach the problem of strict resource limitations. They may look at different costs depending on availability, and also, Sandholm and Baker have looked at some variants on that. There's a wide variety of auction literature. I've talked about the simultaneous ascending auctions. That there's rich literature in that, as I mentioned there.
I wouldn't really say simultaneous.
Okay.
I wouldn't try to mention
names on those, because there's so much auction literature.
Okay.
It's kind of arbitrary choice, but...
For any of the auction literature?
What?
For any of the auction literature?
Yeah, for any of it.
Okay.
You might have the sub-goal as a simultaneous ascending, direct mechanisms, combinatorial mechanisms.
Okay. Well,
but you're not, I mean, I wouldn't try to say much about that. I think just the point that there's a lot of relevant auction literature. It's not like you're really contributing to that.
Yeah, there's a lot of literature, and there are some approaches such as general bigquery auction and combinatorial auctions, which basically aggregate the decision-making allocations for goods in one location, which can potentially, you know, give a much higher efficiency, sometimes optimal, but there are other trade-offs in that. So, my research plan, I mentioned that I've only empirically established that about the solution convergence. I'd like to actually prove that conjecture. I'm working with Jet Propulsion Laboratory to actually model and implement some of these, model and implement this system in the unmanned spacecraft domain. I'd like to evaluate the adaptivity properties of the protocol. I touched on the problem of when new consumers come in, and can we reallocate to meet the new value? We can also look at problems where resources are lost, and I'd like to know how well the system responds to added value or reduced cost, and does it gracefully degrade or...
And by doing it in December 99, it'll be just in time to weather the Y2K.
That's right. And...
Additivity properties in advance of that.
And over the long term, I also really like to develop a model of and analyze the strategic incentives for these various portions of the protocol. And 2 years from now, I'd like to complete the thesis. And my contributions are, by the time I'm done, I will have a decentralized solution method that combines a task allocation and scheduling. And what's really new about this is it includes both the supply chain dependencies and strictly limited resources. Also, this quiescence detection protocol is, to my knowledge, is quite novel in the field of computational economics, and that's very important to implement these computational market systems in decentralized.
So, I mean, I'm screwed up, but I think those two bullets are just really not equal.
Okay.
The first one is much more significant than the second.
Okay.
What I might suggest is just getting rid of the sub-bullets under the second, and maybe add another set of things at that level. So, the main thing is you've got this decentralized solution method, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of on the side, you've got quiescence detection, efficiency analysis, additivity properties, all those things that go with it. They're
mm-hmm.
all sort of just equal things about that, but they're sort of enhanced the main show, which is the method itself.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, so add more bullets under this at this level, or a little bit?
Yeah, actually...
At the same level as quiescence.
Yeah, or maybe group them under something else like... analysis and implementation.
Under analysis and implementation.
Right. The question is, by implementation, I don't mean actually writing code, but I mean how to realize the protocol.
Right.
Okay. Crisis detection, decommitment, all the other issues that you've raised.
Okay.
I would raise question detection above those other ones. They really are all about the first thing.
Okay.
Do you have any plans to say anything about the computational costs?
So the computational costs, I wasn't planning on. I can say that the bidding policies and the auctions require nominal computation locally. The real time loss here is communication. There could be a lot of messages sent, depending on a lot of factors. I do have a bound on the number of bids in the system, and we expect that. So the number of bids really determines the communication cost. And so.
That's a good question.
And also the number in taking some problem statement and converting it to your model could be that the number of nodes explodes exponentially.
That's a little...
If
we had agents that were potentially interested in any combination of goods, yes. We would have an exponential explosion.
Actually, yeah, right. What is, looking at a centralized solution, what is the complexity of this problem?
Well, I haven't proven this, but I strongly believe the problem is NP complete to do centrally, because it very closely resembles a minimum and/or graph. Certainly,
and
took.
Is that known to be NP complete?
Yes, computing a minimum weight and/or graph is NP complete. This is a little bit different.
It's restricted, so it might be worth knowing.
I haven't put the effort into doing the translation. Certainly, when I try and compute efficiency using, you know, the A star takes a long time.
Right, but if maybe yours could be doubly.
I doubt that.
Well, it shouldn't be better, but
right.
It's just not obvious. It should be, you know, worse by any particular. You know.
It looks a lot like a minimum weight and/or graph problem.
The analogy with, or the connection with, the minimum weight and/or problem, I mean, that's a computationally burdensome problem, which one might want to parallelize if you have multiple. Exploit them, and what you're presenting is a method for parallelizing as well as decentralizing the solution of a related problem. Is that interesting for I can imagine people parallelizing.
I would be hesitant to argue that this is if you have all the information centrally, I would be hesitant to argue that this is the best way to go about it.
You mean the best way to parallelize it?
Well, you have it all centrally and then you break it up, parallelize it.
Generally, when you parallelize an algorithm, not the best thing to do is to have one processor in each node and only look at your closest neighbor. It's not the best.
Since we've gone over quite a lot, probably should end it. But thanks for your patience. And I think it's raised a bunch of things that will come up. And of course, the committee's going to raise just all sorts of other.
So I know we started late. I can't remember when we started. Am I roughly okay on time here?
Yes.
Okay.
But I think you'll need to monitor that dynamically because there's going to be, you know, shock events, you know, regressions, and you may need to think ahead of time about where you might recover time.
You can skip stuff that you couldn't skip with us because they'll have read the paper. So.
That's a risky assumption.
Well, I mean, if you need to make up time, you might be able to say.
So it's all right. So they were supposed to have read the paper.
Right.
So you can.
Oh.
You can.
Right.
You can say. Yes, you're right.
Since you. I'll breeze through this section. Right.
No, it's a little bit. They pretty well. Do we have a topic for next week? I don't remember if we set one. Anybody want to set one? Might be worth mentioning one of those points, though. One of those. You have to get several things in your portfolio that you haven't
ever talked about.
Okay. Yeah, let's figure out what it is.
Can you be?
Okay, so we've got that set for next week.